said Wells and the robber barons, straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about three reports. And if time permits, give an update as we have been on our running report of what's going on with the so-called trade war. And we'll look at that at the end of the show. Just an update. But I want to talk about a couple of reports here in the main part of the show. And I understand that some people have indicated our sound is not all that great. Well, we're going to update our equipment here and maybe get some clearer sound here in future shows. Okay. The first thing I want to talk about is this report by the U.S. Labor Department Bureau of Labor Statistics. Okay, the report is on what's called precarious work. Precarious work. What do we mean by precarious work? Well, it's what's called the sometimes contingent alternative work arrangements, contingent labor alternative work arrangements. Well, what do we mean by contingent? Contingent means that an employer, a worker, does not have a regular, full-time, permanent, full rights relationship to its employer. You know, we had for many decades in this country, you go to work for somebody and you're hired as full-time permanent. You work 40 hours or 35 to 40 hours a week. You get paid based on a wage structure schedule for all employees. And you are eligible for all the benefits the company may offer and the working conditions and all the legal rights according to the state labor codes and so forth, and federal government, as all the other employees are. You are for full-time permanent, as they call it. Well, contingent means that you are none of the above. Your job is could be just a temporary job, or it can be a job that's on call, or you may be a contractor of sorts working for the company. Maybe you were a regular employee before, but you got laid off and they hired you back as a contractor. Meaning they pay you not for all your time spent, but only for a fraction of that working as a contractor for the company. Maybe you're hired through a temp agency. Maybe you are a contract employee. You work for an outsourcing company that contracts you to the regular employer, and of course that regular employer can cut your relationship at any time, make a complaint to your contracting employer, and you're gone. Well, there's all kinds of such arrangements. These are called alternative work arrangements, and contingent means various kinds of not permanent relationship, or not traditional as in the past. And these numbers have been growing significantly, not just in the U.S., but even more so in Western Europe and Japan. All the advanced economies are turning to this kind of a labor relationship. Why? Because it's cheaper. First of all, they don't have to pay you for all the hours you would work if you were full time. They have total control over the hours they want you to work or let you work. Your wages are less. Not only the amount of hours you work is often less, but the wages, you are on a two-tier wage schedule. You don't get paid as much as you would if you were traditional full-time. You get no benefits, virtually, very few benefits. You're exempted often from belonging to a union if there's a union there by law, if you're an independent contractor, you see, or a consultant or a freelancer, right? You just don't have the coverage under the legal system, as minimal as that might be. Other elements of your employment, you can be eliminated. We don't need you today. You could show up. Oh, we don't need you. Go away. Lots of things. This is contingency. Alternative work is, alternative work is mostly independent contractor, consultants, on-call, temp agency kind of work. Of course, contingent labor overlaps with alternative work arrangements and vice versa. And of course, the latest expression of this is the development of the gig economy, where people simply sign up for some kind of work online with a company that controls the customer and puts you in contact with the customer. Who are you an employee of? Well, that's not always clear. Uber, Lyft, these are the best examples of gig, but there's proliferating other kinds of companies doing gig work, like TaskRabbit and Airbnb and so forth. It's just spreading to all kinds of occupations. These are all kinds of what we call contingent alternative gig work or arrangement, non-traditional kind of work. And the importance of this is that these people get paid less through lower wages or fewer hours, and they have no benefits, and they are precarious. Their employment relationship is precarious, can be ended immediately, quickly, with no rights. And it's almost impossible to organize these people. The Teamsters have been trying to organize independent contract truckers for a long time, but the law says they are companies, and companies can't join unions, you see. So that's the way they keep these people out. Trucking companies lease their equipment to the truckers who are independent contractors and prevent unionization that way. Big problem in the trucking industry, for example. It's a big problem in higher education, where 70% of all the professors now are lecturers. And if you don't have a union, and very few do, lecturers, then what this means is you may get a job this semester if you get enough enrollment in your classes. This is rampant, by the way, in community colleges. You may get a job if there's an enrollment. If your class does not fill up, well, then you don't have the job, and tough luck. You get nothing. This is very prevalent now. 70% of all the instructors in higher ed, and colleges make a lot of money, save a lot of money, reduce costs by hiring lecturers and adjuncts. At the same time, of course, they're raising their tuition to students and keeping the difference. We got this explosion of administration numbers and salaries. College presidents think they're CEOs of companies now and should be getting multi-million dollar packages, which they do. All right, so these are just two areas. Temp work has been expanding in the auto industry for some time, temporary workers, two-tier, all the two-tier wages and benefits structure in manufacturing. Those on the second-class tier, of course, are not regular employees, right? And less wages, less benefits. All right. Companies have figured out a way that this is how they intensify exploitation, how they keep more of the wages that you should be paid by shifting traditional work to a contingent part-time temp work. Okay, so the government, U.S. government, Labor Department, has periodically been looking at these numbers. In the 1990s was the first time they started looking at contingent labor. By the way, at the same time, the labor markets in the U.S. have been restructuring towards contingent labor and alternative work. They've been also increasing the number of involuntary part-time work. That's not considered contingent involuntary part-time work. It should be, because we're talking about millions of people here. It's mostly work that is not permanent, you might say. Okay, so voluntary part-time work began accelerating under Reagan and has ever since, and contingent labor has been accelerating since the 90s. And there were some reports in the 90s, but then the last report, 2001, and then another last one, 2005, and there hasn't been any report ever since. Well, the Labor Department just came out with its latest supplement, you might say, a report that just came out here yesterday, in fact. And the Labor Department concludes that this is not a problem, right? That the numbers are not increasing. The numbers of people working part-time who are temp, contingent, alternative work relations, you know, contract labor, consultants, this is not increasing. Well, you know, if you look at the data, though, and look at the Labor Department, how they define contingency and alternative and gig, you see that there's some real problems with this report. And by the way, I just wrote a piece in print. You can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and some public blogs it's on now, ZNet, Global Research, etc. The piece is called U.S. Government Survey on Precarious Jobs, My Critique. Okay, precarious is called, it references the fact that these jobs are not really traditional jobs. Their relationship to the employer is, quote, precarious. In other words, can be easily, legally, and otherwise eliminated. And therefore, if that's the case, they pretty much can do what they want, wages and benefits with these workers. And this is a problem. It's sometimes called the precariat, as sort of a takeoff on the proletariat, you see, the precariat. These kind of jobs, for example, in Europe, 70-80% of all the hiring since 2008 crisis, or 2011-13 second double dip recession in Europe, 70-80% of all the jobs have been these precarious jobs in Europe. Even in Germany, 60-70% of all the new hires have been precarious. And in the U.S., it's pretty much the same thing. That's why, you know, it doesn't make sense for the Labor Department to say this is not increasing. Everybody out there knows these kind of jobs are increasing. By the way, a big problem with this report is that it doesn't provide numbers at all on gig work, you know, on Uber and Lyft and B&B and all that stuff. It doesn't provide the numbers. It just looks at what's called contingent and also what's called alternative work relations. Another problem, other than there's no gig estimates in these numbers, another problem is it defines, the Labor Department defines contingent as only your primary job is contingent. Well, a lot of people have a primary job and they're working a lot of secondary contingent jobs, whether they're in gig work or not, you see. So they exclude all the secondary jobs that may be contingent alternative, they meaning the Labor Department. In addition to that, the Labor Department defines contingency as in its interviews to determine the scope and magnitude of this issue. Contingent is only if you expect to work a year or less, you see. If you've been contingent for a long time, well, they don't include that because they assume, well, if you've been hired as a contingent and you're still working at such more than a year, well, then you're not really contingent, you see. which is nonsense, because some people are in this situation for multiple years now. The Labor Department defines contingency based on time, hours of work that you worked, and also whether you expect to work past 1 year or not. Well, I have a problem with that, because contingency should be defined based on a second-class citizen, work citizenship. See, it shouldn't be based on time. It should be based on whether you're stuck in a job on a two-tier wage schedule, or you're not eligible for the benefits that the regular traditional employees get, or you have no rights of retention. You can be fired at any time, or you're exempt from certain state labor code provisions and so forth. This is how we should be defining this as the second class citizen here that's been growing in the labor force. Right? Well, what are the numbers that the Labor Department study comes up with? Well, first of all, it assumes that the 2017-18 supplement just published shows that not only are the numbers not growing since 2005 in the last report, but actually are slowing. Just that alone makes one suspect of the accuracy of this report. Well, what are the numbers it comes up with? Well, the Labor Department report showed that only 3.8% of the U.S. workforce, which is about 165 million, are contingent. In other words, roughly 6 million are contingent. That's all. And another 9.5% are in what's called alternative work arrangements, meaning independent contractors, on-call, temp agency employment, et cetera, about 15 million. So we got about 20, 21 million people only out of 160 plus million in the labor force who are, quote, in precarious jobs. Now, remember, this doesn't include any of the gig work here, right, which is growing very fast. There were studies, by the way, that came out a couple years ago by a couple Princeton economists who estimated that somewhere, 20-30%, I forget the actual numbers, are precarious contingent, and the numbers are going to grow even more rapidly. Well, the Labor Department, that report or that study by private academic economist Princeton caused a bit of a stir. Because what it means is that if we have such a large number and growing of precarious jobs, we have a large number of people who may be getting jobs, but whose wages aren't growing. They may even be declining, offsetting wage growth for other people who are traditional full-time. And the same thing with benefits. Why do we have Obamacare? Because there's so many people who don't get benefits from their employer. Well, how many of them are really precarious, right? So it has generated concern that maybe part of the problem with no wage growth going on, it has to do with the growth of precarious work. And, maybe part of the problem of the uninsured has to do with precarious work, or the lack of preparation for retirement has to do with the growth of precarious work. So there's real policy implications, and suggests the government needs to do something if these numbers are growing. And they may have something to do with the relatively slow growth since 2008 of the U.S. economy and consumption. And therefore, the need to take on even more debt in order to survive consumption-wise and standard living by most households. All right? So, we got a problem here, according to the Princeton study and other studies, that suggested there needs to be some policy. Now we got the government BLS report that says there's no problem. In fact, it's getting better. Therefore, the government needs not to do anything.
if there's no problem and it's going away, well, there's some real problem. The problem is with the assumptions of this report. If you look below the surface, right, of this report, well, first of all, no gig work, fastest growing sector in this BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics report, right? In addition to that, you know, they constrict the definition of contingency by limiting it to hours and 1 year or less, mm-hmm. Referring to time, as I said. Secondly, they define temp workers very narrowly. You see, the only temp workers they consider are workers who are hired by temp agencies and sent to companies. Well, a lot of companies are hiring people on a temp basis, and they're not going through temp agencies. This has, of course, always been a factor in temp definition of temp employment going back to the 1990s. The numbers are much larger for temp if you acknowledge that a lot of temp workers aren't hired through agencies. A good example is the auto industry, where a lot of, in recent years, since 2000, a lot of the hiring has been direct of temporary workers who are on a kind of a two-tier wage schedule with no benefits and no rights and outside the union and so forth. By the way, this whole contingent thing is a way of further undermining unions and even union busting, and certainly undermining collective bargaining, because you got a group, a large group of workers who have no protection if the rest of the workers go on strike. You got a built-in strike-breaking force, in other words. Right? That's why another reason why employers like it. But you know, the temp, the number of temps is much larger than the study suggests here. And what about public workers and higher education teachers? I couldn't find anything in this BLS study, even their technical note, that says that they've included higher ed teachers, right? This is the 70% of higher ed, higher education college instructors who are adjuncts and lecturers, right? Well, they're certainly precarious. You know, if you don't get the enrollment in your class, well, the class is canceled. Mm-hmm. And what lecturers have to do is line up temp jobs, one class here or there, you know, in several different colleges in the locality in which they live, and in the hope that maybe half of them would work, would get enrollment. And if they don't, then tough. You never know what your income is going to be. Mm-hmm. The SEIU, Service Employees International Union, did a good study of this not too long ago. Right? Well, if they aren't included in this BLS survey, or if their weight, you know, within the whole group of contingent labor is underestimated, well, then you're going to end up with a lower than actual estimation of the number of contingent in the public sector. And that might also be the case with public home health care workers and even the growing number of K through 12 part timers, particularly in charter schools. Mm-hmm. And then there's another problem here that the BLS survey does not address. Mm-hmm. What's going on in the tech industry is really disgusting, and it's beginning to spill over elsewhere. Tech companies hire interns, some of them, without pay for 3 to 6 months. Yeah, you go to work for them and you produce for them like a regular employee and you get nothing, no pay for at least 3 months. The idea is, well, let's see if you can do the job. If you are, then we'll permanently hire you. You see, it's kind of like a no pay probation, no pay, no benefit probation period. well, the problem is, the companies abuse this. They bring a group of people on, you know, coders or whatever, for 3 months, 6 months sometime, and then they don't full-time hire them, and they bring another cohort on. Right? They just keep rolling over the no-pay interns. Yeah, that's growing on, growing practice in tech. You know, aren't these people super contingent? Yeah, I would say so. Super exploited, too. And then there's another practice in tech that even for skilled worker tech jobs, companies require as part of the interview candidacy process that these workers in the interview have to solve problems for the company. They're actually given projects and tasks to do. And sometimes it's projects that the company's regular employees weren't able to really resolve, and they give it to potential hires, and they have to resolve it, and they do this a couple times, a couple levels, before they actually hire you. And what about those who aren't hired? Well, they don't get paid for that work. Well, that's a form of contingency as well. Or, you know, we have this exploitation going on with students and workers, would-be workers, in what's called software coding academies, which are popping up everywhere. You pay money to the academy to get your software coding knowledge upgraded, or actually try to break into the tech industry. So you pay money as a worker to these people, and these people link you up with actual companies who give you a project once again, and you perform this project. You don't get paid for any of this. You perform the project, and then they don't hire you. Maybe, your coding academy cohort of students of 100, so maybe a couple get hired and the rest don't. But every one of them produces some work for the company, you see. Yeah. Well, this is contingency too. Another problem with the BLS survey is that it was conducted in May. Well, we know a lot of contingent labor is hired in October, November, before the holidays, right? A lot of contingent, of course, because they get laid off in January, in retail, in wholesale, in warehousing, and transport even, you know, by UPS and so forth. FedEx, et cetera. Well, if you do the survey in October, November, you got to come up with a larger number. Well, the BLS does it in the spring, you see. Did it in the spring here, April, May. By the way, the study by the Princeton economist here, I think one was Kruger, did do their survey and their estimation based on October, May employment levels. Okay. And there's other exclusions here, too. Day laborers are excluded. What about farm labor? Aren't they contingent? Yeah, they go from employer to employer, from farm to farm during the harvest, right? And that's a seasonality thing. If you surveyed them August, September, you'd find a lot higher number. And what about the underground economy now, which is 12% of U.S. GDP, and undocumented workers, right? They aren't picked up accurately, I believe, in this, because this is the Labor Department contingent survey we're talking about is based upon the monthly CPS survey, right? Population survey. That's done by the Labor Department, which is a 60,000 a month phone calls that are done to households, right? Current population survey, CPS survey, is a household survey. Well, there's problems with that household survey, you see, because if it's based on phone calls, they're going to underestimate the people who are transient workers, you know, like day laborers and undocumented and so forth, right? They're going to miss them. You got to have a landline, or only recently the Labor Department is starting to add cell phones to this phone survey. But the phone survey is biased towards more established workers who tend to be more traditional work arrangements. So it misses, and it certainly misses the undocumented. Even if an undocumented worker has a cell phone, he's not going to answer a call from a government, right? And the same with inner city youth who are hustling on various kinds of jobs, right? You can call them consultants. Assume that it's been restored here, and we're just going to continue. The music came on. I don't know where that came from. All right, someone pushed the wrong button. So what? Let's go forward. All right, so we're talking about the shortcomings of this BLS survey that underestimates and lowballs the number of contingent alternative work, precarious work in the economy. Right? We were talking about inner city youth not being accurately picked up, and undocumented and transient workers and so forth. What's the problem of the survey in general, the CPS survey in general, which is the basis for this study? You know, just different additional questions they asked in their survey to try to determine the extent of contingent alternative work in that survey itself, right? You know, so what about casual workers? You know, in the longshore industry, a lot of workers are casual, contingent, called B-men. Were they picked up? Were farm laborers picked up? Were day laborers picked up? Right? There's a lot of problems here. Now, some people say, oh, well, you know, on the left, all this focus on contingent work, precarious work, is a distraction from the real problems and increasing exploitation going on with real work, in other words, non-contingent work, traditional jobs and so forth. Well, yes, that's true. Intensification and exploitation is going on there as well. But that's not a reason we should ignore what's going on with the precariat, which is a growing problem where there's even more exploitation and abuse than there is even with traditional work. So both are getting worse in the U.S., and we should be focusing on both of those. Okay. Well, anyway, that's my take on this report, and also my view on the limits of the CPS survey, government survey that estimates unemployment, by the way. The unemployment rate comes from the survey. So my critique of the limits of this survey, the CPS survey, with regard to contingent estimates, contingent job estimates, applies to non-contingent jobs as well. Right? That's why you can't take the unemployment numbers too seriously. They're not very accurate. Right? Just the general direction. You see, because if you hire a part-time, involuntary part-time or contingent or temp or whatever, for purposes of unemployment, it's considered a full-time job for calculating unemployment. So if for example, if companies are reducing their full-time permanent workforce and hiring two part-timers, it looks like they're increasing their workforce. Well, in terms of headcount, they are. But in terms of total hours worked, they're not, you see. That's a problem in general. And, of course, if we got a growth of involuntary part-time work and temp work, then it undermines the veracity of the Labor Department's job numbers. Okay, let's move on to a second report that I think is important to note. And this has to do with central banks, right, and banking in general. In a couple days, in Switzerland, the people will vote in a referendum on June 10th on what's called the Vollgeld provision or proposal. What does this mean? Well, Vollgeld will mean that the Swiss central bank will have to shift to what's called full reserve banking. Well, what's full reserve? What do we mean by full reserves? Well, according to all the central banks, the private banks affiliated with them have to keep certain liquidity reserves on hand. You see, people come in and they ask for money, their money back, and take it out and so forth. So they got to, banks have to keep some reserves on hand. The whole banking system, capitalist banking system, is based on what's called fractional reserve banking. Well, what is fractional reserve banking, and how is that different from the Vollgeld full reserve banking proposals going to be voted on by the Swiss people, right? Well, fractional reserves is an idea that means banks don't have to keep the amount on hand equal to the amount they loan out. They can keep a fraction of the reserves, in other words, the money, the liquidity on hand, and loan out more than they have in the bank. This goes back to the 18th century, you see, when money initially was always gold or silver, mostly gold, right? But then the banks began to create paper money, currency. This was trade credits. It begins with trade credits. They called it bills of credit, you see. It was the beginning of creating paper money and using it as equivalent of gold money. Well, initially, in the 1780s or whatever, bills of credit were assumed had to be one-to-one for the amount of gold out there. In other words, you couldn't create money in the form of credit, paper, currency, more than the amount of gold that you had, because the argument was that would lead to inflation and so forth. Well, it soon became clear that the economies were growing so much that you couldn't keep up the creation of gold. You had to dig gold out of the ground, you see, or knock somebody on the head and take theirs. That's called wars and conquests. So you didn't have enough money to fund the growth of trade and the growth of the capitalist economies in the 18th, 19th century. So they had to create another form of money. And this was paper money, currency money. And at first it was assumed you had to keep one-to-one ratio. Well, it became clear that not everybody was coming in, and we weren't always in a crisis, a banking crisis. So banks could loan out even more of the paper money, just as they would loan out gold and commodity money, gold is called, right? So the reserve requirements began to decline. Then 50%. And by the end of the 19th century, banks were required to hold only roughly 25% in most cases of reserves on hand. They couldn't loan out. Now, if you're a bank and you can't loan it out, you can't make any profit on it, you see. So banks like to loan it all out. But the problem with fractional reserve banking, when they loan it all out, is when you have a crisis and people want their money, there isn't any. And then the bank fails. And then people get concerned about their bank, maybe it's another bank, and they go down and say, I want my money out. And the bank says, well, that's not how we do banking, right? We loan all this money out so we can make a profit. And the customer says, I don't care. It's my money. Give me my money. Well, we don't got it. Sorry. Okay, crisis, banking crashes. That's what happens. When you have fractional reserve banking, that's a small fraction. Whenever there's a crisis, and people want their money, there isn't any, and the banks collapse as a result. Well, that's why they form central banks, to bail out the banks when they collapse. That's the number one function of central banks. It's the number one function of the Federal Reserve, which was created in 1913. And initially, the Federal Reserve required 25% reserves, you see. There's a contradiction here. If you don't loan out more and more money, you can't finance more and more growth. But if you loan it all out and you have a small fraction when there's a crisis, you got banking collapses, you see. So fractional reserve in good times promotes economic growth, but in bad times, it's a big contributor to crashes and banking collapse. Okay. Well, central banks were created to bail out the banks when fractional reserves were insufficient, you see. Central banks also functioned as raising money for their governments from private bankers to fund government wars and infrastructure projects and so forth, and building up their military, et cetera. central banks are just a phenomenon in the last couple hundred years, except for the Bank of England. And central banks have assumed the function of trying to control the money supply, influence the money supply. Now, supply of money in the economy occurs only when the private banks make loans. But the central bank can influence that by increasing the amount of money in the private banks. And it does this by various means, by manipulating up and down the reserve requirement, by the discount rate, by what's called open market operations. But it's the private banks that create the money supply. But the central bank can influence how incentives in the private banks will increase or decrease the money supply. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a big function of the central banks. And the central banks are supposed to supervise the private banks, but in the U.S., private bank supervision has been purposely kept fragmented and fractured. So no one institution can really supervise the private banks effectively. The private banks, when they don't like the supervision of one agency, they'll go to another. And of course, they pay for politicians who help them significantly in this regard, in key positions, banking chairpersons in the Senate and the House. Treasury is always a banker, U.S. Treasury Department, et cetera, and all these other agencies, controller of the currency and so forth, right? Keep it fragmented, fractured, so that no one can really supervise them very effectively. So bank supervision, lender of last resort, bailouts, in other words, influencing level money supply, funding government. These are the major functions of central banks. Right? Now, in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, right? And but we're going to get back to this Volgeld thing. Hold on. That I just published this past year. What I argue is that central banks have lost control of influencing the money supply, because for decades now they've been pumping all this excess liquidity money into the banking private banking system, and the private banking system is so overbloated now with money that it's lending more and more to speculators who are destabilizing the economy and so forth. Right? Okay. I'm not going to repeat that. Read the reviews of my book on my website and blog, as well as my summaries there. Right? And the Fed, of course, was created in 1913-14 in order to bail out the banks, which the private banks could not bail out themselves in the 19th century, and the U.S. Treasury and politicians didn't want to do it and get the blame. So they created this new institution called the central bank, the Fed, to do the bailout in a way that people don't quite understand, the public doesn't quite understand. Okay. But what I argue in this book, that the Fed, because it's pumping so much money into the economy and other central banks too, is losing control of its influence over the money supply and therefore over interest rates. Losing influence, the degree of influence over the money supply. Also, technical changes, technology, and financial structure means that banks and investors can create credit without money. Yeah, credit without money. Yeah, that's increasing. And even the nature of money is changing, i.e. cryptocurrencies and so forth. All these things mean that the Fed is losing control of the monetary policy tool that it once had. It's failing. And you can see it in the fact that the Fed had to engage in quantitative easing, where now the Fed directly creates money, doesn't go through the private banking system, creates money and buys up bonds and other securities, corporate bonds, and in Europe and Japan, even stocks, from private investors. So QE, this new radical experiment that was necessary to pump $25 trillion into the global economy after 2008 to bail out the banks, yes, 20 to 25 trillion, and then the central bank assumes the debt. You know, it just transfers this bad debt from private banks to its own balance sheet. That's what QE is about. QE represents a direct creation by the central bank of money in the economy, not an indirect through the private banks, but a direct. Well, you know, this has opened up a Pandora's box for the central banks and for the system itself. And what we see is that not only $6 trillion in QE created in the U.S., and the rest is created in Europe, Japan, China, but all this excess money has led to increasing excess debt. As we've reported, total debt in the U.S., private sector debt, has risen from $50 trillion to $70 trillion since 2008. Okay. And by the way, in my book, I have a proposal at the end, the constitutional amendment, my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, that would make the Fed a national public bank and require it to provide bailout services when necessary to all the economy, small businesses, workers, consumers, etc., not just the banks. Okay, well, I'm not going to go into details of that. I will post that in a week or so, that concluding chapter in my book on how the central bank must change into an institution that serves the rest of the economy and has to be democratized. You see, the people running it can't be bankers, which they mostly are, with a assaulting of academics. That's what the Fed is. But the bankers indirectly run it, the districts, and through the government, etc. So, the central banks have to change. They have to change. There's a crisis in central banking. The tools aren't working as much because of technology and all this excess liquidity injected for decades now, and changing nature of money and so forth. The central bank is at the end of its ropes and has to be reformed. Well, this is what gets us back to Vogelt, right? This is a proposal to reform central banking. And the whole idea of fractional reserves. Okay, well, what is Vogel? It's sometimes called sovereign money, a sovereign money solution, or how the, like QEE writ large, you might say, right? Fiat money, sometimes it's called, right? Well, it's really a form of perpetual bailout of the banks. What it means is that excess debt, will not be held on private banks' balance sheets. It'll all be transferred permanently and totally to the central bank. So that if there's a problem in a financial crash or something, the private banks will not collapse. There won't be any problem with excess debt that the private banks can't service, and those can't pay principal and interest, therefore they'll collapse. It'll all be on the Federal Reserve, on the central bank, and the central bank will just create an electronic entry that creates more money electronically, internally, to offset all the losses, because the losses will be held on the central bank's balance sheet, you see? Well, that's just a perpetual bailout. That's all that is. That's what Vogelt is. But it's interesting because it represents an attempt to prepare for the next financial crisis. You see, the next financial crisis, the central banks won't be able to bail out the private banks the way they did in 2008-09. In other words, pump all this extra money into the system, QE, $20-25 trillion, because it hasn't really bailed out the private banks, you see, particularly in Europe and in other places, Japan and even China. We still have maybe $10, $15 trillion of non-performing bank loans. This is a big problem, by the way, in Italy. This whole Italian debt crisis is really risky because the private banks in Italy are still loaded up with debt, government debt and their own debt, private debt. They're still in trouble. Particularly, you know, Bank Monte dei Paschi and Banco Popolare and even Intesa, you know, all the big banks are in deep trouble in Italy. And even the biggest bank, UniCredit, moves are underway to allow the French bank, BNP Paribas, to buy UniCredit, to merge with UniCredit, to bail it out. You know, after 10 years almost in the Eurozone, the private banks are still loaded up with all this non-performing bank loans. Non-performing means that the loans that the banks made, which the principal or interest or both, are not being repaid. So they're defaulted loans, you see. All this was very clear in the Greek debt crisis. You know, it erupted in 2010, again in 2012. When the euro economy slipped into a double dip, and again in 2015. And by the way, the debt as a percentage of GDP in Greece has not really improved much. Unemployment is really, you know, in the 20% plus range, depression range. And the Greeks are being squeezed, Greek workers and households and small business being squeezed to generate income that basically goes to the Greek state and the Greek central bank and goes to the European central bank. And from the European central bank, all that austerity income earned goes to the private banks in Northern Europe. Yeah, 95% of all of the income generated from austerity measures in Greece ends up in the banks in Germany and Netherlands and other places. This is a kind of financial imperialism, as I write in my book, Looting Greece, in 2016, a new kind of imperialism that's debt-based, that's paying interest on debt, that's organized by supranational government institutions like the European Commission and you know, European Central Bank, that controls the banking system in Greece and continues you know, extracting surplus income due to austerity and funneling it back to the center, you know, the Euro center, which is Germany, right? This is like imperialism, except, you know, you're not putting up a factory and paying people small amounts and keeping the profits by reduced costs and sending the goods back to and the profits back to the home country. You know, that was classical imperialism, right? Well, this is financial imperialism, and it's state-organized, super-state-organized forms of imperialism where the stronger, larger economies exploit the weaker ones in an organization like the Eurozone. Yeah, that's how the new imperialism works. It's debt financial-based. You can read my piece, an excerpt on how Greece is a microcosm and an example of financial imperialism. Well, Italy is the same thing. Financial imperialism has been going on. The banks, the Italian banks, are totally insolvent, some of them, right? And the others almost insolvent. Capital, money capital has to be injected in them from someplace. Well, it either comes from the European Central Bank or it comes from other banks, private banks like Paribas, that are buying out, you know, buying up or trying to buy up the debt and get it off the balance sheets of these Italian banks because they're about to collapse. Well, now you got this government coming in five star and says, we're not going to play this game anymore, right? New movement, new government there. Just as it was in Greece, called Syriza. Well, you know, the Northern European ECB, EC, totally squashed Syriza and brought them to heel. So they're just a conduit now for this financial imperialism system. Well, you know, you got the five-star movement, which is kind of like a Syriza, Italian version of Syriza, coming to power. And we'll see whether they're going to follow the track of Syriza and, you know, play ball with ECB and EC and Northern Europe banks, or whether they're going to strike out on their own and say, no, no, we're not going to continue this austerity squeezing our people just to pay interest to you bankers. We're not going to do that anymore. Well, that, you know, that may be a source of future conflict between the two. They're also saying we're not going to play this monetary policy game anymore, where our central bank, Italian central bank, is just an appendage of this European central bank controlled by Northern Europeans, right? And we're not going to play that game anymore either. Well, that could break up the Eurozone. Well, we'll see whether and how that's going to play out. Italian debt crisis, Greek debt crisis writ large, as I've said, read my article on jackrasmus.com. Well, think of Vogelt and the Swiss experiment as a way of trying to prepare for the next crisis by saying that the central bank, ECB in Europe, Fed in U.S., Bank of Japan, Bank of England, so forth, and the other countries, is not going to bail out the private banks in the same way, you know, where we just give it money or access to free money, zero interest free money in the tune of trillions of dollars. We can't do that because we're maxed out on that solution, right? So what we got to do is create a Vogelt solution, which means all the debt will sit on the central bank. In other words, banks will never go bankrupt. Yeah, that's what they're trying to say. And instead of this fiction of the central bank bailing out the private banks by giving them all the access to free money, you know, we'll just stop the fiction and we'll put all the bank debt on the central bank so the private banks can never go bankrupt. Well, what's this going to mean to risk-taking by the private banks if you can't go bankrupt? Well, gee, talk about too big to fail. That's just an insurance that you're, you know, too big to fail. And the banks will go, bankers will go crazy with high risk taking and so forth. Anyway, that's Vogelt, right? Well, we'll see. It's a perpetual bank failout. In my book, I say that the central banks like the Fed have been evolving anyway towards a permanent subsidization of the private banking system. Well, this Vogelt is just another example of permanent subsidization. Okay, we'll watch that vote on June 10th and report here in our next show. And we'll keep the running tally going with the trade war, so-called, and the Italian debt crisis. And of course, we'll see what new comes up next week, which will, I'm sure. And we'll try to improve our audio here as well. Okay, that's it for today. Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus. Sit hard and sit well, send the robber bars straight to hell.